Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. In this episode, I'm going to preview a case called Janus v. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME for short, which is going to be argued on Monday, February 26th, 2018. Now, this case is a First Amendment challenge to public employee unions' collection of agency fees, which are also referred to as fair share fees, which are the fees assessed by a union on non-union members who are represented by that union for purposes of collective bargaining. In order to understand this case, we need to step back and look at an earlier case. There's a case called Abood v. Detroit Board of Education from 1977. Now, the Abood case was an action by some non-union member teachers against the Board of Education and the union representing the teachers in Detroit. And this union, it was what's referred to as an agency shop, where the union represented all employees in collective bargaining, including non-members, and the union was able to deduct the union dues from the paychecks of all employees. But in addition to collective bargaining and other what you might refer to as core union representational functions, the union was also involved in political activities that went beyond the narrow workplace representation. Now, the court in this 1977 opinion kind of distinguished and divided between two different types of activities that unions are involved in. And on one side, they refer to what you might think of as the core representational functions. And this was collective bargaining, contract administration, and grievance adjustment purposes. And the court said, with respect to those activities, it was legitimate for a union to collect fees to cover its expenses related to those activities from all employees, regardless of whether those employees were members of the union. On the other hand, for political or ideological causes that a union was involved in, the court held that the First Amendment protected employees against being compelled to contribute to causes or speech that those employees disagreed with. So that left a situation where unions, with respect to non-members, were able to collect fees representing their costs and expenses related to those core union workplace representational functions, but not for the broader political activities that the union might be involved in. And that's basically been the governing law for the past 40 years, ever since the Abood case. Now, there's some difficult line drawing between what counts as a representational activity and what counts as ideological activity by a union. And there's been some later litigation, including some Supreme Court cases that have dealt with things like how to draw that line between political and representational activities, and also things like procedures for notifying members, non-member employees, and opportunity for those non-members to opt out of these payments for political activities and things like that. But the Abood case has provided the general framework in dividing between these two different categories of union activities. So that brings us to a case 2 years ago called Friedrichs v. California Teachers Association. Now, this was a case brought to the court, argued before the court in January 2016, which was a direct challenge to the Abood precedent. It was an argument that the Abood precedent should be overruled and that the court should hold that the agency fees, the fees collected for the collective bargaining and other core representational functions, even those fees should be deemed unconstitutional because they're compelling speech in violation of the First Amendment of the non-union members who are being assessed these fees. And again, it was argued in January 2016, but only a month later, Justice Scalia died unexpectedly, leaving the court with only 8 members. The 8-justice court divided 4-4. And as a result, the court's practice when the court is equally divided is to affirm the lower court decision by an equally decided court. And when that happens, the court doesn't issue an opinion, just issues a simple one-line order saying that the lower court's opinion is affirmed by an equally divided court. And that affirmance carries no precedential value. It just basically decides the one case before the court by leaving the lower court decision in place, but doesn't provide any precedent for later decisions by other lower courts. So the issue is left open to be decided by a future court. So that brings us to the Janus case. The Janus case is raising that exact same issue that was there in the Friedrichs case, whether the court should overrule Abood and rule that these agency fees, the imposition of these agency fees on non-union members, is a violation of their First Amendment rights. Now, importantly, the only membership change since the Friedrichs decision is the replacement of Justice Scalia with Justice Gorsuch. And so, presumably, the other eight members who were divided 4-4, assuming they none of them change their position between 2 years ago and now, Gorsuch will presumably be the deciding vote. His vote will decide whether this case goes 5-4 one way or 5-4 the other way. Now, you never know for sure, and sometimes things do change, but that's at least going in. That seems to be the starting point. So it'll be very interesting when this goes into oral argument to watch Justice Gorsuch in particular and see if there's indication from the argument of where he's leaning. The general assumption, the court, when it divides evenly like that, doesn't even indicate which justices voted which way. But the general assumption, which I've seen no reason to doubt and seems to be universally accepted, is that this 4-4 divide is between the four it's a stereotypically ideological division, with the four more liberal justices voting to retain the Abood precedent and the four more conservative judges voting to overturn Abood and hold that these agency fees are unconstitutional, at least in certain applications. And so the Justice Gorsuch has, in his brief tenure on the court so far, has tended to fall into the conservative camp and side with the other conservative justices. So that leads a lot of people to believe that that this is a likely win for the challenger, the petitioner in this case, but it remains to be seen. Sometimes there are surprises when these things actually get to opinion. So let's talk about the facts of this particular case. So the union involved, AFSCME Council 31, represents 35,000 employees in dozens of Illinois agencies, departments, and commissions. So this is a pretty sizable public employee union in Illinois. And the petitioner, Janus, is a child support specialist employed by the state. And in this particular case, the agency fee that's assessed on non-members by the union amounts to about 78% of the full union dues. So those non-members, they're not paying the full union dues, but they're paying a significant chunk of it, about 4/5 of the full union dues. And that's the amount that the union has assessed as being attributable to the core representational functions, to the grievance procedures, to collective bargaining expenses, to the overhead involved in those tasks. And so that fee is what Janus is objecting to. So I'm going to run through right now just some of the basic arguments that Janus is making, and then we'll go and look at the union's arguments on the other side. So as I mentioned before, Janus is calling for explicitly overruling Abood. And the core argument here is that when you're dealing with a public employee union, when the party on the other side of negotiations is the government rather than a private employer, that there really isn't a principled line between bargaining with the government as employer and lobbying the government, seeking political action or political change. And the argument is that many of the things that can be done as a matter of collective bargaining, so issues that could be negotiated over at the bargaining table and could end up being a provision in the union contract, those same ideas could be also accomplished by lobbying the government, lobbying the state legislature, and getting a law passed that would provide the same benefits or protections to public employees. And the argument also is that many of the issues involved in collective bargaining, when you're dealing with the government as the employer on the other side. Many of things that would normally just be core collective bargaining issues are inherently political and become the type of thing that is of great public interest and often enters the very public political debate. And some of these are issues, for example, about merit pay and tenure protection, which are sometimes are very controversial issues dealing with schools. Another major issue is the funding of public pensions, something that's there have been various crises in municipalities across the country in recent years over public pensions and how they're funded, and promises that are made to workers about future pensions, and that's a major political issue, even though that's also a core collective bargaining issue. And another issue that in most private employers would just be seen as kind of a purely private matter between the employees and the employer is the procedures in place about grievances and disciplinary processes. But in certain public employee contexts, those have been highly salient political issues. You can think, for example, of issues that have been raised in the recent Black Lives Matter protest movement relating to disciplinary procedures for police officers accused of misconduct. And that's been a major point of political controversy there. Another related one is there were some years back a scandal in the New York City public schools related to what was referred to as pejoratively as New York's rubber rooms, where it was said that teachers who had been, for one reason or another, determined to be unfit to be in classrooms were housed, warehoused, because they were the school system was unable to actually fire them, so they were being paid to sit in a room and do nothing. And these were kind of major scandals and major issues of public attention. But again, they also go to kind of core collective bargaining functions that a union would normally deal with. So the argument here is when you're dealing with the government, you can't really draw this clean line between collective bargaining issues and political activities. And so that's the basic general argument. And Janice also argues that the precedent here, starting with Abood, is out of step with other First Amendment precedents. In most areas of First Amendment law, when the government is going to impinge on someone's First Amendment protected rights, the government has to meet what's referred to as the highest standard of scrutiny. It's sometimes called strict scrutiny, where the government has to show that the reason that it's infringing on people's rights is that it's the narrowest means of achieving a compelling government interest. And that's the case in other types of compelled speech cases or compelled political association cases. And the argument here is that the Abood case doesn't require that kind of the government to meet that kind of burden, so that this is out of step with other First Amendment law. And the argument is that same high standard should be applied here. And according to Janice, the government can't meet that standard. Janice also argues that the current rule in the public employee context. Doesn't provide a good clear line between chargeable and non-chargeable expenses, and it's difficult for non-union members to effectively police the union's charges to make sure that they're not actually paying for prohibited political activities. And then there's also arguments between the two sides about what the effects really would be of overturning Abood and not allowing these agency fees to be collected. With Janice and some of the other supporters of his position, there's in this case, there were dozens and dozens of amicus briefs, this friend of the court briefs by non-parties who are interested in the outcome. Dozens of these briefs filed on both sides of the case. So there's a lot of supporters on either side because issues involving unions, especially public sector unions, are just highly politically contentious. So arguments are made that the effects of getting rid of these agency fees wouldn't really be that bad on unions, and actually there might be salutary effects where unions would be forced to be more responsive to their members and paying more attention to member satisfaction when they actually have to ensure that people voluntarily join the union before they're going to receive any money for them for union purposes. And on the other side is that there's a major free rider problem. The union, because it represents all employees in collective bargaining and grievance procedures, all employees, regardless of whether they're a member of the union, are reaping the benefits of the union's representation. If they're not, if employees who are not members are not required to pay these agency fees, then they're just free riding on the payments being made by the union members. The Janus argues, characterizes things differently and argues that these non-member employees are not free riders, but at this point they're what they're referring to as forced riders, people who are being forced to support something that they don't actually see as a benefit. And they point to the fact that it's inherent in when conflicting interests are being represented, especially in very large unions, there's always going to be conflicts between the interests of different groups of employees. And you might, for example, have the conflict between current employees and retired or near retired employees who may have very different positions on, for example, pensions, or the correct balance between benefits and salary. There may also be disagreements between different groups of employees on issues of merit-based promotion or advancement and seniority-based systems, and just various differences over different workplace rules and policies that are involved in union negotiation. And the argument is when you have someone who believes that their particular interests are not the ones that are winning out in the union's negotiations, then they're not really a free rider because they're not actually seeking the benefits that the union is providing. Janus also argues, so I mentioned before the argument that other areas of First Amendment law require the government to show that they're meeting a compelling government interest. And Janus has argued that this area of the union agency fees should be governed by that same level of scrutiny. And Janus argues that the government really doesn't have a compelling interest that it's seeking to serve here. And some of the interests that have been raised on the union side are the issue in promoting labor peace. So the idea is this was an argument made in Abood that one of the benefits of having an exclusive bargaining agent is that it promotes good harmonious relationships between the labor and management, and prevents helps to prevent violence or just disruption in the form of strikes and other labor unrest. And the government has a compelling interest in promoting that. Janus argues on the other hand that Abood, for this labor peace idea, relied on private sector precedents, where clearly there may be a benefit to a private employer of dealing with only a single representative and having everything funneled through one exclusive union to allow to make it easier to come to some sort of amicable agreement. But when you're dealing in the public context, where we're dealing with the government, generally the idea of eliminating or reducing competing voices is antithetical to our general ideas of democratic governance. And usually it's considered better to invite a multiplicity of voices and allow everyone to be heard rather than trying to funnel everything through one official speaker. So the argument is that interest is really is not a real compelling government interest. Janus also argues that some of the benefits that the unions put forth, for example, that there's strong interest in there being not just an exclusive union representing the employees, but also that the union be well funded so that it's able to serve its function as being a counterweight to the employer in these negotiations. that may be a benefit to the union and maybe to the union members who agree with the union's goals. But that does not necessarily make it a government benefit. That makes that's the government doesn't necessarily benefit, especially in negotiations, by having a stronger, better funded negotiator on the other side of the table. That's Janice's argument. Janice also deals and some of the amici, the friends of the court in this case, address the issue of what's known. Lawyers refer to it by the Latin phrase stare decisis, but just that basically just means the idea that precedents should be respected, the idea that a precedent should not be lightly overturned, even if a later court or a later judge believes that it may have been wrongly decided as an initial matter. It should be left in place, absent some strong justification to overturn it, because that promotes stability in the law over the long term and predictability, and allows people to rely on decisions and in making their in planning and making decisions going forward. Various arguments are raised as to why the Abood decision should not be entitled to that kind of weight. And one of those is the argument, which we've mentioned before, that Abood is out of step with other areas of First Amendment law, so that it's kind of an outlier according to Janice, and doesn't really fit with the larger body of law, and it should be made more coherent. Another argument is just that the issue of unions, and especially public employee unions, has just been highly controversial and has resulted in lots of follow-on litigation and disputes ever since Abood was decided. And so it's not really a settled issue, according to Janice, and the court should bring more certainty to this area by overruling Abood. So that's some of the main arguments that are being made on that side. So let's turn to the other side of the table and look at what the union and its amicus supporters are saying. So one of the main argument here is that the assessing fees to support the union's activities is a reasonable condition on employment. And the argument here is that the petitioner, Janice, is repeatedly failing to distinguish between the government as a regulator, so the government as just a sovereign, you know, lawmaker, and the government as an employer. And that there's a general principle that runs through a lot of First Amendment law, that when the government is acting as an employer, it is not bound by the same set of First Amendment rules as it is in other contexts. And that the government, in many ways is given the freedom to act the same way that a private employer would act. So where a private employer, would be within its rights to, engage to contract with a union that was going to be an exclusive representative and collect these fees from its members, then a public employer, the government should be able to do the same thing. And you see this in a number of other areas that would otherwise be related to otherwise be governed by the normal First Amendment. If it was the government as a regulator trying to impose on the populace as a regulator, it wouldn't have the kind of leeway it has. For example, the government has a great amount of ability to demand information from employees or potential employees, and to conduct various searches of their work property. Has a great deal of control over employee speech when they're on the job and functioning as employees, and things like dress codes and grooming codes, where, you know, as a First Amendment, as a government regulating the citizenry, it has very little control over such things under the First Amendment. But as an employer, it can impose very specific requirements in those types of areas. So the argument is this is the same kind of idea. When the government is acting as an employer, it can impose certain things that are reasonable conditions of employment. And one of those reasonable conditions of employment is representation by an exclusive union that allows the government to efficiently bargain and maintain workplace order in a way that is acceptable to the employees. The government also argues that it does in fact have a number of, important interests that are served, has an interest in, exclusive representation, because it allows for a long-term, stable, close working relationship with a particular union, and the union that often is able to benefit the employer, by providing, information about the specific, concerns and preferences of employees that they may not be willing to share directly with the employer. Along with that, the government has an interest in that exclusive representative being adequately funded, in order to avoid undermining the entire, exclusive representation process. If the union is not able to, be sufficiently, well funded to serve as a counterweight to the government in negotiations, then it doesn't serve the exclusive representation function and won't be seen as a credible representative of the employees. On the free riding issue, the union also argues that it's effectively in practice impossible to distinguish between someone you might call a true dissenter, that would be the forced rider under Janus's formulation, the person who really disagrees with what the union is trying to do, from opportunistic free riders, people who are perfectly fine with the union's activities or think, you know, on balance, the union provides more benefit than detriment, but nevertheless would choose to opt out and free ride rather than paying their fair share of the agency fee costs. Some of the supporters of the union have pointed to empirical studies that show that even supporters of unions will free ride when that's allowed. So the union will lose money and membership from people who even people who approve of the union if they're allowed to do so. There's also an argument made by some of the supporters of the union that they make a federalism argument. In other words, there should be flexibility, state flexibility to handle how different states choose to manage their employee relations. Overruling Abood would create a one-size-fits-all regime where every state across the country was required was not allowed to use these agency fees to ensure that unions could be funded by all employees that they are representing. Where in the current situation, you have state-by-state variation, where some states are right-to-work states where unions aren't allowed to collect these types of fees from anyone who is not a member, but other states allow these agency shop arrangements where the union can collect these from all. And some states have different rules for private sector unions versus public sector unions. But this would reduce that kind of variation and choice between different states and the flexibility of states to figure out how they think they can best manage their relationship between state and municipal employers and their employees. The union also argues back about the workability of the line that was drawn in the Abood case. And they argue that really most of the issues involved in contract negotiations, even in public employee unions, are not issues of public political concern. And that to the extent that their argument can be made that every issue is a political issue when you're dealing with the government as employer, because all of the money going to the employees is coming out of the, you know, public funds, coming out of tax dollars. The impact on public funds of most union negotiations is relatively minor, and it's necessary because in any system where you're going to have public employees, those public employees are going to be paid. So it's just that the marginal difference that's involved in these negotiations is not really of major political concern. And also, they argue that lobbying, contrary to Janus's argument, lobbying really is clearly distinguishable from bargaining. And part of that is the exclusive relationship of the collective bargaining unit, where you have the union as the exclusive representative sitting down at the negotiating table with the employer. That's a very distinct context, where lobbying, they're just one of many voices out there, and it's clear it's just a different context and a different situation, and you can easily draw the line between the two of those. And they further argue, the unions argue that to the extent that there really is, you know, disputes about the line drawn in Abood about distinguishing between representational activities and political activities, then that should be handled by clarifying that line. The Supreme Court can hear cases and help to better draw that line and better provide guidance for what falls on either side of that line. But that doesn't require throwing Abood overboard and getting rid of that precedent. And so the union also argues, invokes the idea that stare decisis, which I mentioned, the idea that this precedent should be respected. It's a 40-year-old precedent. There are a number of later opinions that build on it or elaborate on Abood. And as such, there's kind of a body of law in place that shouldn't just be jettisoned and thrown overboard. And they also argue that there's very strong reliance interests, both by the unions and by the government employers who have entered into contracts under these arrangements. So you have numerous labor contracts that have agency fee provisions that specify how the union is going to be allowed to collect certain fees from all the employees. And, you know, there are major processes set up within the unions for distinguishing and tracking expenses to figure out what can be charged to all employees and whatnot. And so everything is kind of built around these precedents. And so there'd be major upheaval if you suddenly in the middle of change the rules of the game at this point. There's also an argument that this would call into question certain other court precedents. I mentioned before that government employee speech cases, where the government has a great deal of control over the speech of employees when they're acting as government employees, it seems like that would be called into question, that line of cases, by overruling Abood here. That's the argument made by the union. So that's that kind of sums up the main arguments on both sides. Before I finish, I want to talk about one other argument that came up in an amicus brief. And the amicus brief is filed on the side of the union in this case, on Ask Me. But it presents a significantly different view, and it's been getting a lot of attention. I think it's worth mentioning. So Abood drew this line between the agency fees for union representational purposes, which were acceptable, and political activities, which were on the other side of the line, which could not be charged to members. And the lineup in this case, that the argument has been between Janus and Janus's supporters arguing for overturning Abood and finding all of those expenses to be on the unconstitutional side of the line. And on the other side, the union in this case and its supporters have basically been nearly universally supporting the Abood line and arguing that Abood draws a sensible and workable line and should not be called in question. There was an amicus brief filed by two professors, Eugene Volokh, who's a law professor at UCLA, and William Bode, a law professor at University of Chicago. And they argue for the position that not that Abood, they argue that Abood was wrong, but wrong in the opposite direction. They argue that Abood was wrong to hold that the union's expenses or the union's collecting fees that went to political speech or ideological functions or lobbying or things like that, the court was wrong to say in Abood that that was a First Amendment violation. Their basic argument goes that the case law is very clear when the government itself is speaking, when the government has some sort of substantive views, the government can spend money to promote its own views on issues, and that raises no First Amendment issue. That's not a First Amendment issue for the government to spend its own money, even though that money was collected by taxpayers who may not agree with the government's position. The First Amendment is not implicated. Moreover, the government can go beyond that. It can subsidize others to speak, and this creates no First Amendment issue. The government can subsidize private parties to speak in certain ways that the government approves of, and that by itself doesn't create a First Amendment issue. And further, the government can and does in certain contexts require private persons to deal with other private parties in a commercial way where they're providing money to those parties. And they give some examples of various educational and licensing requirements where people, in order to obtain certain licenses from the government, may have to provide private educators, may have to pay private educators in order to receive certain training or things like that. There's also argument there is once they've been forced to provide money to private parties, those private parties are free to use that money for anything they want, even if it's some political cause that the person forced to pay that money wouldn't have approved of. And they kind of walking through these different steps argue there really isn't a First Amendment issue implicated if the government says that we want the employees to be represented by a exclusive bargaining agency in these types of negotiations, and as a result, they're going to pay certain money to that exclusive bargaining agent. And then at that point, that bargaining agent, that's the union, should be free to spend that money however they want to spend that money once they've received it from the people that they're representing. And that should be the end of it. And it doesn't matter what they spend it on, whether it's political issues or representation. What makes this brief particularly significant, a lot of it goes to the specific parties who are the amici on this brief. So Professor Volokh, law professor from UCLA, he is a highly influential and highly respected First Amendment scholar. He's written numerous articles that have been very influential on various aspects of the First Amendment. He has been promoting this particular view of Abood for years now. Professor Volokh is well known to be a proponent of very broad First Amendment protections. He's someone who's usually found on the side in a great many types of disputes on the side of very broad First Amendment protections, of broad interpretations of the First Amendment and how far it should extend. Professor Volokh is also a libertarian or conservative leaning professor who has often been a defender of broad First Amendment positions favored by the more conservative side in certain controversial issues in Supreme Court cases. For example, things like the Citizens United case about campaign expenditures and the Hobby Lobby case about religious exemptions for corporations. So he's someone who's kind of well known in more conservative legal circles as a prominent figure who's well respected and generally has a very broad view of the protection of the First Amendment. Yet he's coming out in this case on the side of saying that the argument that's seen as the conservative argument is too broad. It's arguing for First Amendment protection where there really shouldn't be any. So kind of given his background and his general positions, he has a great deal of credibility with people on the more conservative side who may be inclined to be more skeptical toward public sector unions. So it'll be interesting to see whether his view and the view represented in this amicus brief, whether this gets any traction and whether any of the justices either cite this brief or adopt any of the reasoning from this brief. So that's just another interesting thing to watch as this case moves forward. And again, this argument will be on Monday, February 26th. We're expecting a decision sometime by the end of June, the end of the court's term in June when it tries to have all the decisions for the term decided. And that's it for this episode. Please subscribe to Counting to Five on YouTube or on your audio podcast app of choice. For timely coverage of the latest developments of the court, please check out Counting to Five's weekly YouTube live streams where you can ask your own questions in the live chat. We're currently broadcasting these on Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, but you can always check Counting to Five's YouTube channel to see when the next scheduled live stream will be held. And I'm always looking for feedback. please leave a comment or send me an email at mike@countingto5.com. And thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.